Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role do nurses play in the well-being and healing of their patients, and what skills must they develop that can be learned only through experience? Teresa Brown had a PhD in English and was well-established in her career as a teacher of writing at Tufts University when she felt the call to make a midlife change. She went back to school to earn her RN and work as an oncology nurse. Since then, Brown has continued to document her experiences and insights as a contributor to the New York Times Well blog and CNN.com. She's also the author of a memoir called Critical Care, A New Nurse Faces Death, Life, and Everything in Between. And she joins us now to talk about the vast responsibility she and other nurses take on to serve patients and their families. Teresa, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Start, if you would, by telling us a little bit about your career path, because I can't imagine you have many colleagues in the lounge with a similar background.
No, and this is what I call the million-dollar question. And in fact, that's the first line of my book. You left teaching English for this? Because so many people in healthcare said that to me, and I had to constantly reassure people that I was not actually insane. So what happened was I had my son, and then I got pregnant with twins, had midwives for that pregnancy, and I just fell in love with their job. Mm. And so it was by way of wanting to become a midwife that I first found out about nursing. And then once I got into nursing school, I realized I actually knew nothing about what real nurses actually do, and fell in love with bedside nursing and what an important job it is. So I've never looked back. I've never had any regrets. And interestingly, my friends in the academy supported me more than a lot of people in healthcare who just thought it was very, very weird that I made that change. Mm.
Well, it certainly is. In addition, and we'll get into the emotional and intellectual demands, it's a physically demanding job.
It is physically demanding. And it's not the kind of thing I sought out, obviously, because being a professor is a lot about sitting and reading and grading papers and standing in front of a classroom, but it's not a physical job the way most people do it. And I never thought I would have wanted a job like that. And it was being home with the twins and then my son, who was 2.5 when they were born. And I call it finding myself in the soup of life and loving all the chaos, even when I hated it. It just felt like there's something here that's really real about what real life is, and that feeling is what set me off in this different career direction.
What makes a good nurse?
Wow. We could probably talk for a really long time about that.
It's NPR. We've got an hour, so.
Yeah, right. The first thing I thought of was empathy, compassion, intelligence, assertiveness, good judgment, and then this gut feeling that you develop with experience that just tells you something's not right here. I've got to take action in some way, whether that means calling a code, calling a doctor, getting another nurse in the room with you, going to get pain medicine as quickly as you can. So there's a lot of book smarts and just regular old common sense kinds of smarts, listening to your gut, and then really, really caring about the people you're taking care of.
Well, the empathy component seems really challenging to me because I can understand sort of having the emotion you need to respond appropriately to people's needs and the ways that they're hurting. But you also have to balance that so that you're not too drained to take care of somebody in the next bed one room over.
Yeah, exactly. And that's something that we learn on the job. A lot of new nurses ask me, well, how do you get that balance? And one thing I always point out is that in nursing school, we'll go to clinicals, and you go as a group, and you leave the floor as a group. And I realized after I was done with school the psychology of that, because the point is no one stays on the floor at the end of clinical because I've just got to know my patients okay. I've just got to see how this worked out. I've just got to find out what that lab result was. We all leave together. And so you get this conditioning about it's a 24-hour job. You take over to someone else. You have to trust the people you work with. And you learn through experience that you will just burn out incredibly fast if you can't set those kinds of limits. That said, all of us have stories about the patient we, for example, went and bought a newspaper in the hospital for, or they really wanted Starbucks, so we went and got them a Starbucks, or a friend who a patient loved Fruity Pebbles, and she would bring them into him. And, you know, we all have these stories where we go beyond the limits that we've set, but we also keep them in mind because we know we won't be able to keep doing the job if we don't.
Assertiveness is another quality that I think maybe doesn't pop into people's minds initially, particularly if they've spent more time watching TV nurses than
right.
being in their company. But talk about how that plays into the job.
It is so important. And not only does TV not get it right, but I'm not sure that a lot of nursing schools are really working with nurses on this at the level where we need to be. So you probably know about this Institute of Medicine report on the future of nursing, saying we all need to work fully to the full scope of our practice.
Mm-hmm.
And what that really means is that nurses work collaboratively and as colleagues with physical therapists, people in dietary, and physicians. And to do that, you have to have confidence and a confidence about there's value to what you're doing. Your observations are definitely worthwhile and need to be listened to, and that your role as the person who's with the patient for hours and hours every day brings a legitimacy that is unique.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that we're really teaching our new nurses how to do that. And so that also ends up being something you learn on the job. And I remember a new nurse just being scared to even call a doctor, and the other nurses saying, you have to call him, and just coaching her through it, really,
mm-hmm.
because we're not taught how to do that, and saying, you've got to call him, and here's what you say, and see it worked out, and processing it with her, and slowly people get more comfortable with it, but it'd be great if we could just have that skill and hit the ground running when we start.
Is there something about the way doctors are trained that inclines them, unless they fight against it, to sort of not necessarily respect the input of nurses as much as they might?
Yeah, I do believe that that's true. And I could give a very cynical response, but I think it's more helpful to be reasonable, which is to say the way doctors are trained, often they don't learn anything about nurses. And so nurses just become this blob, like the nurses will do that. Did you tell the nurse? What were the nurses doing? And that's, well, weird for one thing, but also just bad in terms of having professional relationships and being able to communicate, because if you see the nurse as just one entity in this sort of undifferentiated nurse blob, you're going to be much less inclined to think that that person has anything to say that's worth listening to. So doctors need to be educated about our role, and conversely, as I just said, nurses need more training in how to show doctors what that role is.
It has to be scary when you finish with your training, when you've been observed a million times doing something, and then you are alone with a patient for the first time doing something that is challenging.
Yeah, that definitely is. And you saying that reminds me of the first time I gave chemo on my own.
Hmm.
And another nurse coached me through it, and you're going to be fine. And I was evening shift, so it was pretty late at night. It was very dark. The patient wanted to stay asleep, so I was trying to do things with minimal light. And I can see pretty well in the dark. It wasn't like I couldn't see. But I was also wearing the chemotherapy gowns we wear in two sets of gloves, and they're really hot because they're plastic. And I just remember sweating profusely, and not just because of the heat, but the nervousness, and am I hooking this up right, and this and that and the other thing. And it took me three times as long as it should have. And when I came out, Katie, the nurse, she said, were you okay? Was everything okay in there? Yeah. But I did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky that I had someone there helping me, and I had the time to take a long time. There wasn't someone breathing down my neck saying, hurry up. But it's scary because it's a huge, huge, huge responsibility, and making a mistake can be lethal.
And you wrote candidly and really movingly in the New York Times about mistakes and how they can sort of affect you to your core, even when they turn out not to have had a really deleterious effect on the patient.
Yes, that was a situation I wrote about where I didn't give two chemotherapies at the same time that were ordered to be given at the same time, but it turned out not to matter as long as the second one was given within 24 hours. So there truly was absolutely no harm done to the patient, but I still remember that feeling of when I got the call at home saying, what's this idarubicin doing in the drawer, and really feeling like someone had just kicked me in the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that's a cliche, but that's really how I felt. And just this cascade of thoughts of, oh, my God, I made a mistake. My patient's going to die of leukemia, which is a little bit, I was turning it into an unrealistic sense of catastrophe, but there are mistakes we can make that end up really, really hurting patients. And that's one thing we are trained very well about. Are you safe? Is this safe? Is the situation safe? You hear safe over and over and over and over again in nursing school. It's like a mantra. And it's a big, big sense of responsibility to live up to that. And after that incident happened, I ended up making the mistake when I'd agreed to work 16 hours, and I said, I will never again do that.
Mm-hmm.
I will never again work more than 12 hours. Because I thought I was super. I know that the data says mistakes go up after 12 hours, but I thought I was better than that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, even 12 hours, I mean, it's not like you have a lot of time where you can sort of relax on the job. How do you pace yourself throughout a 12-hour shift so that you are as effective in hour 11.5 as you are in hour zero?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I should say the data doesn't even say 12 hours. It's after 10 hours mistakes go up. So 12-hour shifts is a controversial issue within nursing. Is that really the best way of giving care to our patients? On the one hand, if mistakes go up. On the other hand, when you've got someone there for 12 hours, they're there with the patient for the whole day, and the likelihood of a ball getting dropped is much lowered, unless, of course, as you say, that person is just exhausted. And somehow, again, you just learn how to do it. And I can do a 12-hour shift and be focused and come home and feel like I'm sort of eating dinner while drooling on myself. You know, go to sleep, not get enough sleep, go back to work, be focused. And then the first day I have off, I'll sleep, you know, a big part of that day.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's training. The training kicks in. But it's hard. It's hard to do. It's, you know, sitting at home eating dinner, drooling on yourself.
Especially when three kids are looking to you for attention and time and love. And
exactly. It's less than ideal. Yes.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking this hour with Teresa Brown. She's a registered nurse and a contributor to the New York Times Well blog and to CNN.com. She has a memoir as well, which is now available in paperback. It's called Critical Care, A New Nurse Faces Death, Life, and Everything in Between. If you'd like to join our conversation about nursing in 2012, we would welcome your calls now to 1-800-933-5372. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Teresa Brown. She's a registered nurse who is also a contributor to the New York Times Well blog and CNN.com, and she's the author of a memoir called Critical Care, A New Nurse Faces Death, Life, and Everything in Between. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Teresa, when the two shifts change at the end of that 12 hours, obviously there's information about vital signs and bodily functions and how a patient is doing physically. Do you also exchange information about the patient's mood, about whether he or she might expect visitors that day, that sort of thing?
Yeah, all kinds of things. And that's called report. And it's not the report, it's report. And it really has an importance and a clinical significance far beyond the comparatively short amount of time it takes. So, yes, report includes vital signs, past medical history, what's their diagnosis, what's the plan for them, but it can be all kinds of things that they've been vomiting and we've tried this, this, and this to control it and haven't been able to, that the wife is emotionally distraught and is having tearing fits and we're trying to get help for her, that the adult children are fighting over what the appropriate care is and no one can make a decision. I mean, all these things are part of report. So there's clinically what's going on with the patient and then socially what's going on with the patient. And it can even be tricks or ideas that we get to pass on to each other. Well, he was in a really bad mood yesterday, and then I made sure that he always had ice water, and he was in a much better mood. Mm. Or, you know, so sort of, he doesn't like it if you bring in your medicine and say this, but if you say this, that goes over better. So we try to help each other out to make care as smooth and easy as possible.
One thing that you try to be really careful about is remembering that despite their temperament while they're in the hospital and however the family may be reacting, you're often seeing people at a really low time in their lives. And in their minds, their real life is not in your hospital. It's somewhere else. And how do you connect with that element of their life when not much of that is visible to you at the moment?
That is a great question. And the way I do that is by remembering when people come back. And I remember an experience where a patient who we'd had who had a really, really hard time being hospitalized, and I mentioned adult children before because one of his children was going through a divorce and he was stuck in the hospital and he ran his own business, and he had come in a nice guy and ended up being just incredibly unpleasant. Mm-hmm. So the one thing I held on to was when he came in, he was a nice guy, and he's got all these stressors, so that helps.
Yeah.
But then he got a stem cell transplant, did well, and I just happened to be on the floor one day when he came back to see us, and he was really like a new person. Mm. I had never seen this version of him. He was happy. He was smiling. He had a twinkle in his eye. He actually was working a lot less. He tended to work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. He said, now I work when I feel like it. He said his child situation had actually worked out for the better. It was amazing, and it really showed me how oppressive the hospital can be and how it can really distort people's personalities. And this happened a couple years ago, so I can live off these experiences for a really long time.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Roger in Keene. Hi, Roger.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay. I'm a nurse of 32 years.
Oh, great.
And I do want to comment on one thing. She's absolutely right. There is no true preparation for the nurse to learn how to establish a collegial relationship with the physicians. I think that's maybe something that really can't be taught in school as much as your experience as a nurse and your skills being accepted by the physician community. And that sort of moves you up the ladder to be someone trusted. Do you agree with that?
Oh, right. The idea, right. There's always nurses who, you know, the doctors are going to listen to them more easily than maybe another nurse. And it does have to do with trust and experience, just like in any work situation. I completely agree with that. The one thing I would like to say is, I know, for example, at UVA, they have a program where they're actually training the medical students and nursing students, at times training them together. Hmm. And the problem right now is we have a hard time even seeing each other as people. They're just the doctors, and we're the nurses. And for each of us to have some better sense of what the other does, what our responsibilities are to our patients, to each other, would make such a huge difference. Instead of coming in feeling like I have no tools to communicate with this person, and yet they're going to tell me everything to do, in a sense, to take care of my patient. I don't understand why anyone ever thought that would work out.
Well, you know, it makes sense in a way. You're in such a stressful situation. I mean, not every single moment, but a lot. And you can't blame the patients for being ill or having these intractable conditions. So if there's this other, they would become the obvious target for your frustration.
Right, right. But I definitely agree with George, right, that...
Roger,
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Getting good at that and learning it is part of the job, definitely. I mean, it's definitely a job where you learn a lot from experience.
So people might assume, listening to this conversation so far, that that means that you always get along great with all the other nurses and that they are always there to back you up. Talk about when that is not the case.
Right, and unfortunately, often that is not the case. There's a large amount of what people call lateral violence, or I call nurse-on-nurse bullying. And a lot of attention is being given to that problem now, but it's extremely common, and it's very dispiriting when I've written about it because of the number of responses and nurses who say, I left nursing because I couldn't tolerate this kind of environment. Mm. So there's this expression, nurses eat their young, and which is horrible, and I've experienced it myself, and it's terrible, and it's not that hard to figure out. If you look at, we're all in a very stressful situation. Often nurses are overworked. Patients are very sick. We don't have the support we need all the time. Someone's mad at us because we were doing one thing for one patient and we couldn't do something for another patient at the exact same time. And that builds, and there are people who handle that stress by bullying anyone they can, mm-hmm, in their workplace. Mm-hmm. So it often is more senior nurses against newer nurses, but I've heard of it being generationally, younger nurses against older nurses against younger nurses. You know, it can play out any possible way, just depending on what the power dynamic is on a floor.
So mentoring, to the extent that it works and can work, I mean, does it work best when it happens organically, or have you seen programs? I'm always suspicious of programs set up for mentoring because they often feel very artificial.
I agree with you. We set up a mentoring program briefly at the hospital where I used to work, and it didn't really work because the people chosen as mentors were good nurses, but they didn't have any training in being mentors. There wasn't a clear expectation of what the relationship would be and when we were supposed to check in with each other. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to have a program like that, the people actually serving as the mentors need to be carefully chosen and prepped and get some kind of training and have a clear sense of what do we want to get out of this. Mentoring can happen organically, and that is actually a great thing about having a more static sense of staff assignments, because the way it is now, when I first started working, I had this older, more experienced nurse who was fabulous, and I trained with her a little bit, but then she also worked night shifts, and we just ended up not working together a lot. So often I was there, and she wasn't there for me to talk to. Mm-hmm. And that can be a problem, too, with everyone working different shifts. You might not see someone for a week.
Yeah.
And managers also, from what I've seen, are not that good at checking in with new nurses, especially if you've had a bad experience on the floor. I don't mean just with bullying, but a patient not doing well, mm-hmm. someone coding, someone dying. We're just not good as a profession at going to someone and saying, hey, what was that like? Can you talk to me for 20 minutes?
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next on the phone to Jackie in Dallas. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. I'd actually like to have a comment regarding the role problems I see nursing, in the sense that an MA who wears a white coat is considered a nursing staff, an LPN is considered a nursing staff, an RN, MSN, a doctorate nurse is all considered a nurse. And there isn't, doesn't seem to be any sort of equality amongst all of them. There's no boot camp per se or internship where they've all done so they can wear that title with confidence. Especially now that all the hospitals are cutting back and everybody's being sort of asked to do with more with less, I see a lot of what used to be nursing staff that used to do that were not allowed to do unless they were an LVN, for example, being done by an MA. And just like to hear the comment regarding the training and how the variability in training can really produce really great variability in knowledge base and confidence.
What about that, Teresa?
Oh, that is such a great comment. Thank you so much for calling and saying that. That is a fabulous comment and another sort of thorn in the side of nursing, which is this real inconsistency of training. And for years, there have been people in nursing saying every RN needs to have a four-year college degree, a bachelor in the science of nursing, and there's resistance to that. And the point is there aren't great nurses who come out of two-year programs. There definitely are. But there's data that shows you do get better outcomes with nurses that have 4 years of preparation. And obviously, if you have LPNs or LVNs, there's even less amount of preparation. And what I compare it to is medicine. Everyone looks at an MD, and they know what that means. But people look at an RN, or as you say, nurse. And that could cover a whole wide variety of levels of training and experience. So it's confusing to patients, and it also does the profession a disservice. So what I would really like to see happen is that the RN would have a set amount of credentials, and then people would know what a master's degree was, and then what a PhD in nursing meant, and we could stick with those things as a way to really empower us and gain more respect for nursing.
What do you do, Teresa, when a patient asks you a question that you can't necessarily answer? And I don't mean a question about his or her care, but you know, sort of what the prognosis might be. You know, people have these really important fundamental questions. They find a sympathetic ear in you when you've got the time. But there must be things that you think, I can't fully discuss this with this person.
Yeah, I've had that go both ways. Sometimes they're convinced that I know something that I don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I actually described this situation in my book, a family that kept pressing me, and finally they said, we're just worried that you know something about how she's going to do that we don't know.
Right.
And then I could say, no, I don't. I really don't. I'm telling you that you need to hear this from the doctor because that person has the information. I don't have that information. So if the family can actually express what they're worried about, then that's an easier situation. But it's very hard when a patient is not doing well. And truthfully, what happens is that the physicians aren't always as direct with families as they could be. And there's good reasons for that and bad reasons for that. But
mm-hmm.
A little while ago had the wife of a patient say to me, I feel like everyone knows something that I don't.
Mm.
And it was really hard. I really experienced it as a moment of moral crisis. And I don't think I handled it very well. I said, no, he is very sick. And what I would do is I told her, really press the doctors to mm-hmm. tell you exactly what's going on. But the truth was everyone did know something that she didn't know.
Yeah.
And it was just a very hard situation to find myself in. And I'm not sure how I could have handled it better, but I really feel like I didn't handle it well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Fantasia in Dallas. Hi, Fantasia.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
First of all, I just want to thank you for having this show because this is just so important, and I'm a nurse as well. And I want to just say that the relationship between nurses and physicians and this kind of, you know, you're subordinate, you're getting on my nerves, or you're helping me kind of thing, it really discourages nurses from being what they are supposed to be, and that's patient advocates and taking care of your patient. A lot of nurses have fear that the physician's going to get mad or he's going to yell at them or embarrass them, because it really is embarrassing. And I think that discourages us from being what we're supposed to be, which is advocates.
What do you think, Teresa?
That is such a great point. Yes, this is something else I write about and talk about. This is really bullying by physicians. And, you know, it's amazing to me that in healthcare we don't have these set standards for civility in the workplace. There's so many workplaces where you just could not talk to your coworkers the way people sometimes talk to each other in hospitals, and especially how mean and condescending some doctors can be. And it's a small percentage, but it's a consistent behavior pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really hard on nurses to not only not have an expectation of civility, but to know that the doctor can be snide, cutting, belittling in front of a whole group of people. And you can complain, you can go up channels, and something may happen to them, but probably people will just say, yeah, you know, he's like that. It's not good for us.
Teresa Brown is my guest. She's an RN who also contributes to the New York Times Well blog and CNN.com. She has a memoir called Critical Care, A New Nurse Faces Death, Life, and Everything in Between. That's available in paperback. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 1-800-933-5372. If you find the lines all busy, you can, of course, send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is RN Teresa Brown. She's a contributor to the New York Times, to CNN, and she's author of the memoir Critical Care, A New Nurse Faces Death, Life, and Everything in Between. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or think@kera.org. Teresa, you have written very sensitively about the reality that patients feel a great loss of control when they are hospitalized. Can you tell us about some of the small ways that you have found to give them back the tiniest sense that they have control over anything at all in their lives while they're in your care?
Yes, this can be, as you say, small things that to them can make a huge difference. So, for example, I had a young patient once who was 18 or 19, and you can imagine this is someone just finishing their teenage years and to suddenly be diagnosed with leukemia and thrown into the hospital for 6 weeks. And she just wanted a sign on the door that said, please knock before you come into the room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, really.
Like every teenager.
Yeah, and we all should have been doing it anyway. But I put a sign on the door, please mm-hmm. knock before you come into the room.
Mm-hmm.
And she appreciated that. Some people, they want their tray a certain way. They want pills given to them in a certain order. And it's easy enough to do those kinds of things for people. I think sometimes nurses can get into a power struggle with patients, which, well, is just not really being a good nurse, but is also not helping the patient because they're helpless. They're thrown into this really, really difficult situation, And so, okay, yeah, you want this pill before that one. You want this one half an hour later. You know, to the best of your ability, if you can accommodate that, you do it. If someone likes to take a shower at 9 in the morning, you go in proactively and disconnect them from their IV so that they can take a shower. You know, it's not always possible to time things the way people want, but you can try. You can try to, if someone's going down for two different tests, to get them done back-to-back so they don't have to come back up to the floor, get off the stretcher, into their bed, and then half an hour later get back on a stretcher, go back down. All these little things can make a huge difference to people because it reminds them that they're still a human being. Mm.
You know, my mother actually worked as an oncology nurse years ago, and although,
oh, wow.
Yeah, I never got to see her on the floor, of course, I always imagined that maybe one of her greatest strengths as a nurse was that you felt like when you were in her care, you were not going to die that day. Like, she was in charge, and she sort of could make you feel confident. That just knowing her, that's my sense of the feeling she gave her patients. Can you talk about your demeanor and how you might adjust it? One patient needs to feel like you are super nurse. Maybe another patient needs a lot of sort of TLC, and how much you can change from one patient to the next?
Yeah, that's a great question. One thing it took me a while to realize is I do have to have that kind of variety, but while still being myself.
Yeah.
We had this great nurse I worked with who was fantastically bubbly, and, you know, I realized I'm friendly, I'm happy, but I'm not going to be bubbly like her all the time, even though it was real. Her personality was just so appealing,
mm-hmm.
you know, to all of us and to the patients. So that was one thing. Like, you don't have to be everyone. You don't have to be Betty Boop and, you know, Superwoman at the same time. But, yeah, I do definitely try to vary. So if someone is giving off the message, I just want you to come and do your stuff and leave, I do that. I try to just, this is my task, I'm out of here.
Right.
You know, some people, they really do want a little extra mothering. They want someone to bring them a blanket and tuck it in around them. And, you know, that's not hard to do. Some people love to joke, and their coping mechanism is to be constantly telling jokes. And I don't have a repertoire of jokes, but I'm happy to listen. And if jokes are off color or inappropriate, I just laugh. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not there to judge their humor. So trying to be there with them where they are. I mean, obviously, I taught English, so I love to read. If someone's reading, I always say, what are you reading?
Yeah.
And try to talk to their book about them. You know, it can be, you can walk into a room with someone who's been fine and find them crying, and then have to adjust. And, okay, everything stops now. What's going on? What's the matter?
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, it can be fun, but it's it can also be challenging, especially if it's, you know, someone who, no matter what version of your personality you offer them, they don't seem to like it, which does happen.
And it's, how do you learn to cope with the fact that no matter how well you do your job, you can't fix everything for everybody? You can't take cancer away for a lot of them.
Yeah, that is hard. One thing I do is that I just admit that I wish I could do that. And I've even said to people, you know, I meant to bring my magic wand today, but I left it at home.
Mm.
And that's really my wish. You know, in fact, I feel myself sort of tearing up when I say that. That's my wish for them and for me, that I don't want them to have this really bad problem. So it's tough, and I think I just admit that I hate it. I say, I hate cancer. Cancer sucks. I hate it. 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 And every day is not like that, definitely, but there's times when it feels overwhelming and I just own up to it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phones to Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hi there. Been a nurse for years. Started off in critical care for several, and now I place peripherally inserted central catheters for as an independent contractor with a company for several different types of facilities. And first thing I just wanted to say real quick regarding the idea of the ADN degree or the two-year degree, or sometimes it's called a technical degree versus a four-year, for a brand-new nurse coming out onto the floor, it's been my experience that the ones who come out with a two-year degree can hit the floor running a lot better than the four-year nurses can, and it's because they spend the majority of their time in their clinicals working on those bedside skills that you need in order to hit it and run. Now, that's just an opinion on my part. The data might say different. But definitely, I've found that the nurses that come out of those the technical degrees are able to hit the ground running a lot easier, and they're much easier to precept. But the real purpose of my call was just two quick points. Number one, working in as many different facilities and arenas as I have, a couple of things have struck me more and more as we take care of more baby boomers, and that's number one, the absolute lack of living wills, pre-determined care plans for these patients. And as a result of that, the confusion, the infighting, the mistakes that are made as a result of that, not only from the healthcare side, but mistakes on the side of the family because they're uninformed and they don't understand what it means to have a living will and what that means is disastrous. Number two, with the baby boomers that we're seeing, obviously I'm sure that the guest has seen more and more and more of what we might call the big three. That's diabetes, hypertension, COPD. These are predominantly lifestyle-induced conditions that these patients come in with. And as patient education is a major, major part of what it is that we do, it's very frustrating to try and sit down and educate a patient that has spent a lifetime, in some cases, not every case, of course, making lifestyle choices that has in some ways brought them into the state of health that they're in.
Well, Tim, thank you very much for your call. It's a lot that you've put on the table. Teresa, do you want to respond to any or all of that?
Well, I would say very quickly, yes, people need to talk about living wills and what kind of care would you like to have at the end of your life. And that's a huge topic, but the beginning is everyone needs to be thinking about that and make their wishes clear at least. Put them in writing if you can, but at least have a conversation about it. That's so, so, so important. So that's an excellent point to bring up. This question of the so-called diploma programs being the ones who hit the floor prepared, that I've heard that comment from a lot of people, and I did an accelerated BSN program and so had even less clinical experience and was probably in some ways behind that when I started. So that's a good point. I think that BSN programs could learn from diploma programs in terms of increasing the amount of clinical that nurses do and focus on that more, because overall the data shows that you do get better outcomes if you have more BSN nurses in time. So it's that first few weeks, months. You know, hospitals could also have better mentoring programs, work with new nurses on their clinical skills. As the other caller said, should there be an internship for nurses? There's all kinds of approaches to this, but that is a good point. And then lifestyle issues. Well, I mean, none of us is perfect. By the time they get to the hospital, I just have to help them with what their problem is. And this is a huge vexed situation that many, many people are giving a lot of thought to. So far, we don't have good answers.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with Linda in Dallas. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Good. I'm a nurse in Dallas. I've been working for about 28 years. And I think one of the most frustrating things that I experience is that many times we'll find things that would be a safer way to do things, and if the physician's not on board, it's not going to happen. And advocating for your patient can be very difficult, and at times it can be a risk to your job, because physicians are the ones who bring the patients in, and if the patients aren't there, you're not going to make the money. And so just to finalize out what I'm saying is I at one point I had to say, I can't keep the hospital safe for every patient, but every patient in my care will be safe. And that was really sad for me to give that up.
What do you think, Teresa?
That is a really sad comment. There's so much truth to what you just said. And I definitely know that feeling of there's physicians where I won't talk about the patients. I won't bring things up. Because, first of all, they won't listen to a thing I say. They'll be incredibly rude, and it won't make a difference for the patient. But to feel myself withdrawing from doing the best I could for the people in my charge is very, very dispiriting. And we need institutional change to make that different, and a big systemic realization of how important nurses are to patients doing well, which means that it's important to listen to what we say, and again, to have just this basic idea of civility. But you've really brought up a very, very troubling issue about the way we work and some of the obstacles that are in our way that don't need to be. They're not doing any good.
And, you know, so many of the things that have come up this hour, especially we've heard from so many other nurses, is, you know, we puzzle about why there is this nursing shortage when the salaries are pretty good, when there are recruitment packages. But if you get somewhere and half the staff makes you feel like you're not wanted or like you're stupid, you don't want to stay.
Yeah, that's true. And that's what makes me the saddest when I hear from nurses who say, I just couldn't take it. And they're working as nurses in other kinds of capacities. It's not like you ever stop being a nurse, but they're not working in the clinical sphere. And so all that experience gets lost, all that wisdom, all that maturity. And it's such a shame. It's such a shame for patients and for our profession.
What's the best thank you you've received from a patient or a family?
Oh, what a lovely question. I'd have to think about that. It's funny how, well, you know, one day I had a patient who was actually really kind of a pain in the neck, but mm-hmm. he had all these questions that weren't being answered. And so I thought, maybe he's being a pain in the neck because he's really frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made a lot of things happen during the day, you know, got the person needed to talk to him to come and talk to him, and this happened and that happened. I can't remember what now. And at the end of the day, the aide came and said, the patient wants to see you. And I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, what now? and he said, I just want to thank you for taking such good care of me.
Hmm.
And that was really, really nice, in part because it was so completely unexpected. And it really shows you what empathy can make possible in terms of doing a good job. Because if I just thought, he's a jerk,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have made all those things happen for him. And then, there are the patients who bring us in food and buy pizza for us, and that's always welcome, and, you know, send in notes. But maybe the sweetest comment I ever got from someone was who said, you were a good nurse. You came in just the right amount. Not too much, not too little.
That's a high praise. Teresa Brown is a registered nurse and contributor to the New York Times and to CNN.com. She's also the author of a memoir called Critical Care, A New Nurse Faces Death, Life, and Everything in Between. Teresa, it's been a great conversation. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast for free every day at kera.org/think. Email any comments, questions, or suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.